Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc forum called Agency Independence and Accountability to the Executive. Speaking with us today, we are joined by J. Howard Beals III, the Honorable Susan Dudley, Thomas Johnson Jr., and Professor Adam White. And moderating the discussion, we have Svetlana Gans, who is a partner at Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we will turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Svetlana, thanks so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Great. Thank you so much, Edie. Good morning, everyone. As Edie said, my name is Svetlana Gans. I'm a partner at Gibson Dunn, the chair of the Federalist Society Antitrust Executive Committee and the former chief of staff at the Federal Trade Commission, where I led regulatory and process reform for the agency. We are pleased today to welcome you all here. The program is being sponsored by three Federalist Society practice groups: antitrust, telecommunications, and administrative law, and I thank them for their co-sponsorship. I'd also like to thank Federal Society exceptional staff for their assistance with today's event. This panel will discuss President Trump's February 18th executive order called Ensuring Accountability for All Agencies. The executive order directs independent regulatory agencies to submit for review all proposed and final significant regulatory actions to the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs within the Executive Office of the President. We will use the shorthand OIRA for this program. While all major executive agency regulations go through the White House for review, those of independent agencies do not. The executive order noted that independent agencies operate with minimal presidential supervision, even though they exercise substantial executive authority and promulgate significant rules regulating large swaths of the economy. Hence, in order to improve regulatory agencies' accountability and executive branch policymaking, the executive order mandates that, with a few limited exceptions, all independent agency proposed rulemakings must go through OIRA for review. The executive order also ordered the director of the OMB to review independent agencies' obligations for consistency with the president's policies and priorities. Today, we have gathered an exceptional panel of experts to discuss the implications of this executive order on independent agency rulemaking and decision making. Hearing from the former OIRA administrator, former senior officials at both the Federal Trade Commission and Federal Communications Commission, two independent agencies that are subject to the new executive order, and constitutional and administrative law experts. As Edie noted, we will be taking questions throughout the program as well as at the end. If you have a question that's germane to the discussion, please add it in the chat and I will try to get to it as fast as I can. I will also note that we have tremendous amount of materials on our website, educational materials. If you want more information on this topic, we encourage you to go to the Federalist Society webpage for more information. I will briefly introduce the panel. Fuller bios are available on the website. First, let me start with Professor Susan Dudley. She served as a presidentially appointed administrator of OIRA, where she was responsible for the review of draft executive branch regulations, the collection of federal government-wide information under the Paperwork Reduction Act, and the development and implementation of various government-wide policies. She's the founder and former director of the George Washington University Regulatory Studies Center and is a distinguished professor at the GW School of Public Policy and Public Administration. Thank you, Susan, for being with us today. Next, we have Howard Beals. He's the former director of the Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection, among other roles he had at the agency. He also served as a senior leader within OIRA. During his tenure at the Federal Trade Commission, the commission proposed, promulgated, and implemented several rules, including the Do Not Call Registry. He also worked with Congress and the administration to develop and implement the Fair and Accurate Credit Transactions Act of 2003 and has testified in Congress on numerous occasions. Howard is a professor emeritus of strategic management and public policy at the George Washington University School of Business. Howard, thanks so much for being here with us today. Next, we have Tom Johnson. Tom is the former general counsel of the Federal Communications Commission. In that role, he served as the agency's chief legal officer and briefed and argued dozens of appeals in the federal courts of appeal on constitutional administrative law issues and challenges to FTC orders and rules. He is currently now a partner at Wiley Rhine. Tom, thanks so much for being here. Last but not least, we have Adam White, who's an expert on constitutional law, administrative law, and the Supreme Court. He currently serves as an assistant professor of law and the executive director of the C. Boyd and Gray Center for the Study of Administrative State at the Antonin Scalia School of Law at George Mason University. Concurrently, he is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he focuses on American constitutionalism, the Supreme Court, and the administrative state. Adam is a prolific writer, speaker, and commentator on administrative law issues, including testifying in Congress, writing many books, and being quoted in many law reviews and newspaper articles. So, Adam, thank you so much for being with us today. So, with those introductions out of the way, let's get the discussion started. And let me first turn it over to Susan for the first question, which is, can you tell us what OIRA is and what it does in terms of reviewing executive branch agency rules and regulations?
Sure. Thanks, Svetlana, and thanks, Edie, and the Federalist Society for hosting us. As Svetlana mentioned, Section 3 of the new executive order brings independent regulatory agencies under OIRA review. That review is guided by an executive order President Clinton signed in 1993, Executive Order 12866. So Trump's order amends that to broaden the definition of agencies subject to that review to include independent regulatory agencies, except for the Fed's monetary, those that deal with Fed's monetary functions. And it also directs OMB to provide guidance on how to implement that order, how that should be done. So let me first kind of explain what OIRA does and the executive order that guides it, and then maybe come back to the implementation. So, Executive Order 12866 requires for notice and comment rulemaking. So that's rules of general applicability as opposed to case-by-case adjudications or actions. It has two parts. One is analytical. It requires agencies to assess regulatory impacts to ensure that, quote, benefits justify the costs. That kind of analysis of benefits and costs has been required since at least the Carter administration. And it's more rigorous under the order for larger, higher impact rules than it is for lower impact rules. The second element of the order is procedural, and that is, as Svetlana mentioned, before publishing a significant proposed or final regulation in the Federal Register, agencies need to submit them to OIRA for review. So OIRA is an office of about 50 career professionals. So career in that they don't change when the presidency changes. It's in the Office of Management and Budget, which is in the Executive Office of the President. The career staff are called desk officers, and they have subject matter portfolios like energy or environmental protection or workplace, et cetera. And they wear several hats. You know, one is they provide what President Obama called a dispassionate and analytical second opinion on agencies' actions. And so that is they review the regulatory impact analysis as that agencies are required to do and provide that second opinion. So they bring expertise in economics, statistics, policy analysis, scientific risk assessment, law, et cetera. And they add value there evidence suggests that the independent regulatory agencies, which have not been subject to this review, their analyses tend to be lower quality and less rigorous than the agencies that have been subject to OIRA review. The second hat that OIRA wears is that they coordinate across the government. So when a desk officer receives a draft regulation from one agency, it will share it with other agencies across the government and seek their input. So bringing in relevant expertise, overlapping interests, prerogatives, authority. And that's also an important function, I think. Now, of course, I'm an OIRA fangirl. I worked on the career staff in the office and I was the head of the office. But I think that's an important function so that one part of the government is not duplicating or undermining what the other part is doing. And then the third hat that OIRA wears is they ensure that regulations of the agencies are consistent with the elected president's priorities. So that brings some presidential accountability that Svetlana said was part of that, the explanation for the in the beginning of the new executive order. So even though the OIRA staff are career staff, they are part of the executive office of the president. And so they do bring in that expertise. So the policy officials in the West Wing very quickly learn that a lot of important policy happens through regulations. And so they'll coordinate with the OIRA staff as part of that interagency coordination, et cetera. That is probably the most controversial part of the new executive order with respect to the independent agencies. And I expect we'll hear more about that from the other panelists. Let me just back up, if I have time, just a little bit of history. So OIRA was created in 1980, when President Carter signed the Paperwork Reduction Act. So its statutory authority is to review collections of information from 10 or more parties. And that statutory authority does include independent regulatory agencies. So to get that OMB control number that you see in your tax forms and anytime you have to fill anything out for the government, that is part of that act, and it's OIRA staff that do that. So while Carter created it through the Paperwork Reduction Act, signing that legislation, it was Reagan in 1981 who set up the office, and he chose, he decided to give it a broader mission, and he gave it this regulatory review mission. At the time, apparently he had advice from legal counsel that it would be constitutional for him to cover the same range of agencies that were part of the Paperwork Reduction Act, but he chose only to include executive branch agencies and to explicitly exclude the independents, in part because they were already pushing the envelope, and Howard may have more information, more experience on this, but didn't want to get crosswise with Congress, who may have viewed independent agencies as their agencies as opposed to the executive branch. When President Clinton took office in 1993, he operated under the Reagan order for several months before replacing it with Executive Order 12866, which we still operate under today. His order retained both the review and the analysis requirements that were in the Reagan order, but with some modifications. And if people are interested, I could go into detail, but it's probably not worth it. And apparently they also considered whether independent agencies ought to be captured. And what I find quite remarkable about this executive order is that has been retained by every president since. And we know from the last two presidents that a new president can revoke the prior president's executive orders with a stroke of a pen on the first day in office, and they do. And yet none of the subsequent presidents have revoked the Clinton order. And I think that's kind of a remarkable reflects a durability that's pretty remarkable in these polarized times. And I think it's because the order itself reflects good government principles that are nonpartisan. There have also been periodic bipartisan calls to codify the executive order in statute, although that's never happened. And there also there's been bipartisan support for including the independent regulatory agencies. I think one of the things that's one of the documents that Svetlana mentioned that's on the Federalist Society page is an op-ed that Sally Katzen, who was President Clinton's administrator, and I wrote, endorsing the idea that maybe the Biden administration should be the one to bring independent regulatory agencies under OIRA review. Have I talked too long, Svetlana, or should I talk a little bit about I could talk a little bit about what implementation might mean.
Yeah, that would be great. Thanks, Susan.
All right, I'll just do that kind of quickly. Independent agencies often cover similar issues to those that executive branch agencies. In fact, when I talk to international regulators, they try to get me to explain why is one agency independent and the other executive? What's the difference? And it's very hard to explain to them what the difference is. The Consumer Product Safety Commission, of course, is regulating health and safety, just as OSHA and EPA are. The Federal Housing Financing Authority and HUD both deal with housing finance. So there's an awful lot of overlap in the subject matter areas that they cover, but they are structured differently. Independent agencies are usually structured as multi-membered commissions. And so for that reason, if I were OIRA administrator now, I would be looking at a way to implement it that recognizes that different structure. And I think the Paperwork Reduction Act itself resolves that issue, because it, of course, was written to cover the independent agencies. And under the PRA, OIRA reviews, does the review of the agency's information collections. They do the interagency coordination. But if they disapprove a collection, the commission can override that disapproval with a vote. And I think that retains the goal of Congress in setting up these bipartisan commissions. Also, just quickly, the IRS had been exempt from OIRA review for a long time. In the previous Trump administration, that memorandum that exempted OIRA review was reversed and OIRA started review. OIRA also came up with a different implementation procedure, recognizing that the IRS was their regulations were slightly different than the others. So I'll stop there and look forward to conversation.
Just one question there, Susan. You mentioned that for the Paperwork Reduction Act, the commission can vote to overrule the decision. Is that the same for regulations, or does that only apply for Paperwork Reduction Act purposes?
Well, we don't know yet. So it depends on what the Trump administration decides to do in that implementing memo. I think the EO, the executive order, gives them 60 days to write implementing guidance. It's uncharted territory so far.
Thank you so much. So speaking of commissions, let me next turn to Howard to discuss the Federal Trade Commission, how its rulemaking process works and distinct from perhaps executive branch agencies, and what this order might mean for the Federal Trade Commission.
Thanks, Svetlana, and thanks to the Federalist Society for having this panel and inviting me today. I think the OIRA review is going to serve as a very useful backstop for agency economists. The independent agencies differ in the capabilities that they have for economic analysis. And I think FTC, which I obviously know best, is probably one of the stronger. It has a skillful and robust economic analysis capacity. It's better than most independent agencies, and it's probably better than OIRA in terms of the credentials of its economists that are mostly PhD economists in doing cost-benefit analysis. Unfortunately, it isn't always listened to. What OIRA review will do, I think, is increases the chances of both a careful economic analysis that's willing to identify unpleasant truths. And perhaps more importantly, it increases the likelihood that decision makers will pay attention to the results. If the implementing decisions were up to me, I would not let agencies override. I'd retain the same structure as there is for executive branch agencies in the role for OIRA review. I want to turn to another key element of the executive control of independent agencies, and that's the removal power. With President Trump recently having removed the two Democratic commissioners at the FTC. Under the prevailing precedent, which is Humphrey's executor, at the time that was decided that the president could only remove commissioners for cause, the FTC was a very different agency than it is today. The court in 1935 pointed to its quasi-legislative and quasi-judicial roles and the absence of any clear executive functions, and it therefore concluded that restrictions on removal were constitutional. But since it got its ability to go directly to federal district court in the 1970s, that's increasingly become the FTC's preferred mode of action. Today, such cases dominate its activities, and they have for many years. That, however, is a prosecutorial function that's clearly an executive power. Nothing quasi-judicial or quasi-legislative about it. So even if the analysis in Humphrey's executor survives, and it's not at all clear that it will, the result may not, because the agency has changed in ways that make it much more executive and much less something else. Much of the impact of the presidential authority to remove commissioners for any reason depends on the fate of a different custom, one that's not very well known. Until the Clinton administration, presidents sought out nominees for the slots reserved for the opposition party, who were likely to share or at least likely to support at least part of the president's own agenda. Clinton changed that. Instead, turning to the Senate Republicans to identify acceptable Republican commissioners. And that's remained the custom ever since. If it continues, then it's Schumer who will essentially name the replacement Democratic commissioners. Even if Trump's dismissal authority is upheld, we're likely in for a cycle of rinse and repeat if that underlying custom of allowing the minority party to choose the minority commissioners is something that persists. It doesn't have to. It's just a custom. It's certainly not anything in the constitutional statutory authority, but it has been the practice since the Clinton administration. The other point I'd like to make is that the timing of the president's decision is likely to create some significant uncertainties. Although a third Republican commissioner has been nominated for the FTC, he's not been confirmed. And it's hard to see the Senate Democrats as being willing to do so in the present environment. That means there's only two commissioners. Although two can act for the agency if there are only two, were the president to lose the removal cases, there were arguably four commissioners for any decision the FTC makes between now and the end of the litigation. And if there are four commissioners, two is not a quorum. And any decision made on a 2-0 vote, likely many over the course of this litigation, can be called into question. Thus, the remedy is a key question in this case. If the only remedy is back pay, as it was in Humphrey's executor, there's no problem. But uncertainties abound if the commissioners are restored to their seats because of this whole issue of the quorum and how you treat interim decisions.
Great. Thank you, Howard. Can you tell us a bit more on what it means for practice in terms of presidential oversight of independent agencies? For example, the FTC has historically been an expert in its field. Do you think that will change policymaking going forward from the agency's perspective?
Well, I think it will. I think it will increase the attention to careful economic analysis of what it's doing. Parts of the FTC statute require that. The test for whether a practice is unfair, for example, is essentially a cost-benefit test as to whether the practice causes substantial injury to consumers that's not outweighed by countervailing benefits to consumers or competition. And that is cost-benefit in its essence. So the FTC is supposed to be doing that. But there's in some instances there's courts looking over his shoulder. But in rulemaking, that's much less commonplace. Having the president looking over their shoulder is going to cause more attention to be paid to those cost benefit considerations. And I think that's likely to result in better decisions that more recognize costs and seek to avoid unnecessary costs in trying to get to the benefits the commission's trying to achieve. I mean, the process of rulemaking won't look much different. Other than the time that it goes to OIRA for review and before it's actually published, but the questions that are asked and the attention that's given to the economic analysis will likely be different.
And what about outside the rulemaking context into the policymaking context? There's been some concern expressed that the independent agency should stay independent of the executive branch, although there was a lot of coordination in the prior administration between the White House and independent agencies. For example, the Biden White House competition executive order instructed or recommended the agencies do certain things as to rulemaking and other initiatives, and the agencies followed those instructions or recommendations. So how does this executive order impact that independence element of independent agencies?
Well, a lot of what the FTC does in particular is done through case-by-case enforcement, and that's the reason it's more executive than it was in the 1930s. And I don't know that there'll be any impact on those kinds of decisions, and that is the forum for a lot of its policy making decisions. In rulemaking and in policy general, every commission that I've ever seen has paid attention to what the president's interested in and what the president wants to do and what the president wants not to do. I mean, in the Carter administration, a very liberal FTC said, yeah, we'll pay attention to cost benefit analysis and we'll do cost benefit analysis of the rules that are pending. That didn't happen quite the way I would have liked to have seen it happen. But I think it's always been the case that commissioners and chairs in particular worry about the priorities of the president who appointed them and about how their agenda fits with the president's agenda. I certainly don't know of FTC decisions that have been contrary to a clearly articulated presidential policy, although many of them may have addressed policies that the president never thought about because they weren't brought to his attention.
Thank you so much, Howard. Tom, let me turn it over to you to discuss the Federal Communications Commission perspective on these issues. As an independent agency, can you discuss how the order might impact the Federal Communications Commission and maybe talk a little bit about for-cause removal that Howard was mentioning as to the Federal Trade Commission?
Sure, it's fine, Lana. Happy to do that, and happy to be here today. I think the first question, as you kind of alluded to, is the FCC independent? Has it been, in fact, is it independent as a matter of law? And does the Constitution permit the FCC to be independent? You know, scholars of the Federalist Society and conservatives for decades, remember dating back to law school when I reviewed drafts in a seminar I had of Steve Calabresi's kind of multi-volume work on the unitary executive. We've been calling for this for a long time, for the president to exert more control over the independent agencies, for the Supreme Court to overturn Humphrey's executor. And now here we find ourselves, it's happening in real time, and there's heated agreement really among leadership. They're saying it out loud, I think more than they ever have in the past. You had Brendan Carr, current chair of the FCC, at the recent Free State Foundation Summit this past week, saying it's crystal clear that the U.S. Constitution provides the president with authority to remove agency heads at will. He also pointed out, which is true, that the Communications Act itself does not contain for cause removal protections for FCC commissioners. It's the same position that was taken by the acting Solicitor General of the United States, Sarah Harris, in argument just this week before the Supreme Court about the constitutionality of the Universal Services Fund. She was asked a question about, does it matter that the FCC is an independent agency? And her answer was basically, it's not, at least not with respect to the president's power to remove agency heads, which again has no basis in the Communications Act. And why is that the case? It's because the FCC was created during this brief period between Myers v. United States, where Chief Justice Taft cast substantial doubt on the constitutionality of any for-cause removal protections, and Humphrey's executor. We went back to a world in which at least some of these for-cause removal protections were constitutional. So in the interim, you have Congress creating the FCC, Congress creating the SEC, and Congress creating the Federal Power Commission, which is now FERC. In all of those statutes originally, there were no for-cause removal protections because Congress didn't think it was constitutional at the time, right? Now we're back in an environment where likely a majority of the Supreme Court again shares that view. So how did we get here with respect to the FCC? Well, I mean, I think in part it was an inference from some of the other provisions in the statute we heard about today that, you know, there are staggered terms for the commissioners, that there's this requirement for partisan balance among the commissioners. And then it was just custom that accrued over time. It was sort of these unwritten rules that were kind of passed down generation to generation, almost like the common law, where when I was general counsel under Chairman Pai, there were, career civil servants have been there for decades who would kind of say things like, well, you can provide technical assistance to the White House, I mean, you can kind of explain how an FCC regulation works. You can't take direction from the White House. You can't be involved directly in policy formation with the White House. And, and that's not written anywhere. It's just something that everyone just sort of followed as a matter of sort of unwritten custom. And, it gets you into difficult situations, right? Because you've got executive orders where the federal government has significant equities and the FCC, as putatively an independent agency, had significant equities. And as some of the other panelists were saying, there was a lot of overlap in terms of who had jurisdiction over certain things. So, when we would interface to provide technical advice to the White House on things such as team telecom review, sort of how does the federal government evaluate whether certain transactions should take place because of potential foreign threats, or another executive order, which was, some of the most fun I had at the FCC, was kind of thinking through Section 230, and the White House released this executive order directing the NTIA to file a petition for rulemaking at the FCC. And Adam Kandub, who's at NTIA now is at the FCC as general counsel. And imagine a world in which you really couldn't coordinate on that, and you'd have one hand asking the other hand to do something and not really knowing, are they on board? As a matter of statutory authority, could they do things? And so some of these norms kind of created friction, a lot of friction in the federal policymaking process. I was told stories. I can't cite you chapter and verse. You have to go back to an old law library. But, people had been around long enough to know there was a time when independence really created problems at the FCC. You had, I think it was during the George H.W. Bush era, you had majority commissioners who actually weren't on board with every aspect of the president's agenda. And so there would be cases where you actually couldn't get a majority for something that the White House was pushing. And there were even cases where FCC attorneys had to take a position in court that was different from the position that DOJ would be taking in a different case. So there'd be cases that had an FCC brief and a DOJ brief, and the courts would have to kind of sort all this out of what's the you know, what's the position of the executive branch on this issue? And so it created all of these inefficiencies in terms of how federal policy was created. And, you know, I would take a step back and kind of ask the question that, you know, Susan, you know, started off with, which was, does this make sense? Can you even make sense of any of this when you consider the large swaths of federal policy that the executive branch already controls? I mean, to cite just one example that matters in the FCC context, I mean, the Department of Commerce, right, apart from being a sprawling agency, jurisdiction over all sorts of different sectors of the economy, also contains an important part of communications policy. The NTIA within the Department of Commerce regulates the use of spectrum that the federal government controls. So you have, subject to direct presidential control, questions surrounding the use of spectrum for defense systems, the use of spectrum for transportation systems, use of spectrum for aviation systems, and all of this stuff. And why aren't we concerned? Why aren't we all horrified at that? Well, because just like the Department of Defense, Department of Energy, people who have the nuclear codes, people who are directing the military, we put that under direct presidential control, civilian commander in chief. Why is it that this slice of communications policy needs to be relegated to, you know, this particular, you know, group of experts, and the White House can't even touch it? So I think that there's really a course correction here that to me makes a lot of sense from a public policy perspective. But the reality is, I mean, we've been sort of going down this road for a while. This is sort of a culmination of a process. I mean, to begin with, the chair, and Howard kind of, you know, went into this with the FTC, the chair and the title of chair and the responsibilities of chair have always been, you know, given to someone at the pleasure of the president, right? So that's why you always generally have the chair rowing in the same direction as administration's policies, right? You know, this I think kind of came to a head, I think kind of was in a very public way when the FCC under President Obama and Chairman Wheeler turned on a dime, did a complete 180 in terms of how it was going to approach the regulation of broadband. It was set to sort of proceed down the road of using its authorities under what's called Title I of the Act, much more light touch regulatory authorities, to regulate broadband. And then President Obama releases a YouTube video basically saying, calling upon the FCC to regulate broadband under Title II, under basically like a common carrier, like the old monopoly telephone networks. And despite the fact that the notice of proposed rulemaking really didn't say anything about it, the FCC turned on a dime and it, you know, it put its policies in the same direction as the president's. And there's a lot, I think, irony and hypocrisy there when you think of the Democratic Party dating back to Woodrow Wilson and FDR and the faith in ruled by experts, the faith in the government bureaucracy. And now you had a change in what was supposed to be kind of a technical question of telecom regulation being set by the White House. But I think, you know, again, that kind of continued through the first Trump administration, through kind of the technical review process that I was mentioning, and then to the Biden administration, where you mentioned, Svetlana, the competition EO, which, again, sort of the fictions in some of these EOs of saying, we're asking the FCC to adopt certain policies or to consider certain things, right? And there'd be these weasel languages. But you had, you know, the chair of the FCC standing behind the president as he signed the executive order. And I think we all knew that, you know, the chair and the president were going to be rowing in the same direction. So to a certain extent, I think a lot of this, it's a lot more transparent. I think that when you're talking about communications in particular, I mean, what can be more democratic than sort of how do we communicate with each other? How does that look? How should that be regulated? And so putting that under direct presidential control, to me, makes a lot of sense. Now, the questions that it does raise are these implementation questions we've been talking about, which is sort of how do we move forward from here, where the FCC has been going about its rulemaking in a certain way for a long time. As Susan says, you know, paperwork reduction act review, information collections, that was always been part of it. But now you're going to have to go through this formal OMB, OIRA review process. So, you know, under Chairman Pai, not having to go through that process, even though kind of bipartisan desire of presidents to get to where we are today, but we weren't quite there yet. So one advantage of that was, you know, we were releasing 6 to 8 items a month, you know, doing a lot of great deregulation, unleashing the American economy for 5G services and all of that. We were able to do that because we were coming out, we were kind of doing that churn month after month. And the FCC by statute has to hold an open meeting every month. And so there's a lot of churn. The FCC does a lot more than a lot of other federal agencies. And so, you know, just from the outside now looking in, a question that I have is, will OMB, OIRA review, if you're asking for equities throughout the federal government, is that going to slow down the pace of someone like Chairman Carr, who has just, you know, been trumpeting everything he's been able to do in the first 2 months, even without a majority, very much trying to push the Trump administration policies forward? What is OMB review going to mean for that? And what my prediction is, and what I'd like to see happen, is that the agency used the White House sort of uses a scalpel, you know, rather than a mallet, that it looks case by case. And it says, look, you know, we've got certain policy priorities. We want to make sure you're aligned. We're not going to be doing line editing of each of these items. Maybe they're big picture items that we'll take a closer look at, but we don't want to slow you down if you're helping to push our policies forward. You know, I think that the executive order we're talking about has some room for that. It has, you know, designation of a White House liaison. It envisions that OMB is going to create sort of agency specific guidance for each of the agencies. So that's something moving forward, I think, is going to be very interesting to look, just as a matter of process. How is rulemaking going to look like at the FCC over the next 4 years?
Great. Thank you so much, Tom. We do have a question, and Adam, we'll get you right after this question from the chat, which is, you know, what are the long-term implications of removal power? We all understand that the president selects the chair, but does that also mean that president, if there's a Democratic president next time around, he or she will fire all the, you know, non-commissioners who are not from his or her party? So can Tom or anyone, can you talk about that question from the chat?
Well, that is certainly what happened when the president's removal authority was upheld for the CFPB. Is pretty immediate replacement when a new president takes office. It's easier when there's only one. It's harder to find five names than or three. Yes, it can be weaponized the other way. And it is to the extent that multi-member commissions have provided a certain amount of stability across administrations. I think that's eroded a lot in the last few years, and the Lena Khan experience at the FTC makes that completely clear. I think that's something we've been that's something that's going to be changed by under this executive order and the removal authority.
Great, thank you. And we'll get to the other questions at the end of the session. But Adam, let me turn to you. Can you talk a little bit about agency accountability and whether a nuanced approach is needed?
Sure. Thanks, Svetlana. Thanks to the Federal Society, and thanks to everybody who's tuned in today. So many smart things have been said so far. Let me just add a few more thoughts on top in terms of accountability and next steps. I'll have basically 3 points, one about the short term, one about the medium term, one about the long term. In the short term, I think that both this new executive order and the firing of the FTC commissioners and the NLRB members, the National Labor Relations Board members, I think it's going to force among the lawyers and the judges a much more focused and complicated conversation about executive power. Here's what I mean by that. For the last decade or so, it's been clear that the Supreme Court has real questions about the old precedents on agency independence, including Humphrey's executor. So far, we've been able to have that conversation at a very high level of generality. First, the court struck down a novel agency structure where you basically had one independent agency within another, and that was pretty easy for the court to distinguish from Humphrey's executor and strike down. Then you have the CFPB case where it was pretty clearly, obviously an issue of executive power, the sorts of things the CFPB was empowered to do in addition to its rulemaking through case-by-case enforcement. But even there, you had just a single-headed agency, which the court could distinguish from Humphrey's executor and strike down. And then also with the Federal Home Finance Agency, FHFA, when they struck that down. Now the FTC and LRB cases force a very direct conversation about these multi-member commissions, which were in theory built to be quasi-legislative, quasi-judicial. And as has been pointed out a few times so far, ask about the executive powers that they wield. And it's quite possible that the Supreme Court is going to follow through next, maybe in an opinion by Chief Justice Roberts yet again, and say that these agencies cannot have independence from the president because they wield executive power. But then we're going to have to have a hard conversation in that about what exactly is the executive power in these agencies? How does it relate to the maybe non-executive powers that the agencies are wielding? What should stay and what should go? There was an interesting Walmart case. Walmart was defending itself against an FTC lawsuit in the last couple of years, and they turned the telescope around. They looked through the other end of the telescope, and they said, because the FTC is independent, it can't wield executive power against us. And those are arguments reminded us that the court could solve the problems we're talking about today, either by getting rid of the agency's independence or by getting rid of the agency's executive power. Because this is now teed up through the firings, surely the most likely outcome is that this is going to be a case about the independence more than the executive power. But we're going to end up talking about both. There's been interesting research about these things. If you don't mind me plugging a couple papers, the Seaboyd and Gray Center at George Mason's Law School has posted over the years. Daniel Crane at Michigan wrote an excellent paper. It's on our homepage right now about the history of the FTC and especially on how to think of the FTC's powers in light of the CFPB case and other recent cases. President Trump's executive order, it covers the Federal Reserve Board in terms of its regulatory power, but it carves off, at least for now, the monetary power of the Federal Reserve. So many of these cases we've argued about in the last few years, they've been in the shadow of the Fed. And surely any argument about independent agencies is going to, one way or another, raise questions about the Fed and its various powers. And for that, again, there's a paper I'd highly recommend, Aaron Nielsen and Aditya Bhamsai. They have a recent paper out from the Gray Center on the Fed and executive power. So we're going to think harder about executive power. In the medium term, the second point I want to raise is we're going to have to think about agency adjudication and enforcement and how it relates to the White House. Given how much more attention this White House and recent White Houses have paid to the independent agencies, it surely can't go without notice that many of the agencies do as much, if not more, through adjudication or enforcement than through rulemaking. The FTC is an example of that. The NLRB is an example of that. And I think it's going to be increasingly untenable to just bracket that off from White House review. The policy judgments that come out of those adjudications, the costs and benefits of those policies and adjudications, I don't think they're going to be bracketed off from White House oversight forever. Who knows what it might look like for OIRA to start paying attention to adjudications? Maybe it's instead of ex ante, it's ex post. Maybe after an agency imposes a major policy through adjudication, that there will be some kind of obligation to start thinking after the fact about costs and benefits and to report to the White House. Who knows? But I think in the medium term, there will be a gravitational pull of non-rulemaking policymaking into the OIRA framework. But the last point I want to make, maybe is the most important, and it's been teed up by a few people, including maybe especially by Howard, is this decision, this executive order, is going to have really interesting second and third order effects on how the agencies operate and then how they interact with the courts. We should think about appointments. I think it was Howard who pointed out that since the Clinton administration, the president has more or less given the senior senator of the opposite party the primary responsibility in picking the minority members of the commissions. Who knows how that will work now? Who knows whether President Trump is interested in Senator Schumer having that role in the appointments process? Who knows if Senator Schumer wants that role in the appointments process, if he knows that the people he tees up for these minority appointments in the commissions could be fired 5 seconds after the Senate actually confirms their presidential nomination, the moment a president becomes dissatisfied with these members. I think it's going to radically disrupt both on the president's side and on the Senate side, how they think about and vet and nominate and confirm minority members to these commissions. And it'll also change the incentives around who actually wants to serve in those commissions, in those minority roles. We have no idea how that's going to play out. And I don't think we're going to know for years what the new long-term equilibrium is for appointing minority members, let alone removing them. Then we're going to see great changes in the norms between the chairs and those members. Because say the Senate, the lead, in this case Schumer, the lead Democrat, doesn't want to put people forward for these commissions. Well, maybe the president will just pick people, in this case President Trump, maybe they're not card-carrying Republicans, but they're at least not... or at least they're not card-carrying Republicans. They might not be card-carrying Democrats. And just puts them forward either in nominal compliance with the statutes that require bipartisanship or maybe in outright defiance of them. We don't know who the president would pick for the seats in that context, now that it's not, say, Senator Schumer or in the last administration, Senator McConnell picking these people. My guess is you'll get minority members who are much more aligned with the administration, needless to say. That'll make the process in the agency perhaps much less deliberative. You won't get nearly as many dissents. The agencies will be able to move faster and with more unanimity. And there's a lot of good things about that. Again, there's a good thing to having a unitary executive with a lot of energy. But it means the deliberative process will be different, maybe much more muted, and that could either improve or detract from the quality of the policymaking judgments of those agencies. It could also have an effect on judicial review. And again, we don't know what the effect will be, but the dissenting views of commissioners has often informed judicial review. It's sometimes raised alarms about weak points in an agency's final decision. Without those, maybe the courts will become less skeptical of agencies. Maybe they'll become more skeptical of those agencies, sort of across the board, since they know that there aren't the dissenting views that have served a particular role in the past. We don't know how this is going to play out, but surely judicial review of these independent commissions is not going to go totally unchanged by such a sea change in the removal and therefore the appointment of their members. I don't want to overstate that issue. The Federal Trade Commission fared extremely poorly in the courts the last few years, and I think rightly so, but we just don't know the long term what this means. So what I'm trying to say is this: even for those of us who, as a constitutional matter, agree with the basic principle here, the independent agencies cannot constitutionally wield executive power independent of the president. What that means in practice becomes much harder to see, and we should be mindful in the long term of the second and third order effects, the knock-on effects of this sea change in the relationship between White Houses and independent agencies. That's not to say the constitutional issue should be decided differently. I think that's a matter of constitutional principle. It doesn't depend on the practical effects. But for those of us who care about policy, we should also think separately about the policy effects and really not have, or really should have open minds. We shouldn't have closed minds about what that means. We should be attentive to early signs about how the agencies are changing in response to these management changes.
Great. Thank you so much, Adam. Does anyone want to comment on anything that Adam said? Howard?
Yeah, I wanted to ask Adam, your point about adjudication is an interesting one. There's a provision in the executive order that says agencies can't take positions that are different from the Justice Department's position, essentially, on matters of statutory interpretation that would seem to be the leverage to get involved in adjudications. Yeah. And I was wondering to what extent you think that's a possibility.
I'm glad you brought this up. This is a really interesting provision of the order. It's Section 7. We hadn't seen anything like it, as far as I know, floated in the past. And it came so quickly on the heels of the firings, or I guess resignations, of the people in the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York. But I kind of wondered if this, I do wonder if this provision was bolted on at the end. But to answer your question, Section 7 says that no employees of these agencies in the conduct of their official duties can contradict the legal views of the president, which, as you said, means the president or the attorney general. I've looked into this a bit. I don't think it covers the officers of the agencies. So say a minority member of the FCC might be able to take a legal view contrary to an announced view of the president or the attorney general. I don't know what it means, though, for the employees of that member, whether the people, the lawyers or lead staffers, policy folks advising, say, a Democratic commissioner on the FCC, this might on its face seems to preclude them from advocating a position separate from the president or opposed to the president's position. And furthermore, that section is phrased so broadly, it's not limited to official positions expressed by the president in an executive order or by the attorney general in a formal memo, let alone an OLC memo. It's stated so broadly that it seems to encompass the legal views announced by the president on the fly, maybe even on Twitter. And so I think this is, could have huge effects, but I'm not focused so much on the Democratic commissioners so much as the lawyers and policy folks advising the Democratic commissioners.
Thanks for asking that, Howard. That was on my list. So I appreciate it. So we do have just a few minutes left. I want to be respectful of the commenters who posted questions. So if okay with you all, let's turn there. Let's ask three questions that are here. First is, any thoughts on the future of the split enforcement models where the adjudicatory review functions are outsourced to an independent agency separate from the enforcement policymaking agency, for example, OSHA? This often results in executive agencies having conflicting interpretations of law and regulations. Anyone want to take that one?
Well, I can tell you, I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of discussion and a lot of activity in the courts about exactly the scope of agency enforcement authority over the next few years. There was a watershed opinion in the U.S. Supreme Court last term in Jarkissi that held that at least for certain kinds of claims, agencies did not have authority to impose civil penalties, that those civil penalties could only be enforced by a jury in an Article 3 court. And so whether you're talking about kind of split adjudicatory or policy authority or just any federal agency that, as Howard and Adam mentioned, often effectively engage in rulemaking by enforcement, is that going to even be possible anymore? Is that going to be constitutional anymore? You have a separate executive order that addresses just this thing. It says federal agencies should not be engaging in adjudication and rulemaking by enforcement, that it put a halt to any pending enforcement actions that look like that, as well as not enforcing against regulated parties any rules that don't reflect the best reading of the statute. So again, that's sort of this sea change we saw over the last year with the Chevron doctrine, strong agency deference getting overturned. And so I think, you know, we really ought to be looking at this independent agency EO in this broader context, right? The federal agencies themselves are getting reined in, you know, have to stick to their statutory authority, have to stick to the U.S. Constitution in terms of their enforcement powers. And at the same time, their policies have to reflect those of the administration. They have to be more democratically accountable. And I think that this is all sort of related.
And I just add to that, you know, in some ways, splitting up an agency into multiple agencies would be one way to solve the problem of how do you have enforcement power that's accountable to the president, but rulemaking and adjudication power that might have a little bit more independence. That might be one way to mitigate or even solve the independence problem we're talking about here, independence from the president with respect to executive power. It would create other problems, though. And just the example you use, say, OSHA versus the Department of Labor, that's one where it's flipped, right? The executive agency is the one making the rules, if I remember correctly, and the independent agency, OSHA, is the one enforcing and adjudicating cases. But what I want to say is, the more you split this out and create agencies whose primary or exclusive rule responsibility is rulemaking, you create another problem. It's the problem that Justice Scalia pointed out in his dissent in Mistretta, the sentencing guidelines case from 30 years ago, where he said Congress can't just delegate legislative power to an agency that has no job other than just making rules. It's a junior varsity Congress. It's a flagrant violation of the non-delegation doctrine. His colleagues didn't see it so much that way then, but maybe the Supreme Court would today. So carving up these agencies structurally could solve some of the problems we're talking about here with respect to executive power, but might create non-delegation or other problems with respect to the remaining agencies.
Yeah, that's interesting, because the FTC, as Howard knows, cannot, in the first instance, litigate civil penalty cases. And although the FTC can work up an investigation, recommendation, and a proposed complaint, they first have to refer it to DOJ, Consumer Protection Branch, for the right of first refusal to file it in federal court seeking civil penalty. So we do have instances of this split jurisdiction in some cases now. All right, let me turn to the next question. What was the original policy rationale and administrative need that led to the enactment of the Paperwork Reduction Act? Is the cost-benefit analysis mandatory for every new regulation, or is it limited to certain types of rules? And does the Paperwork Reduction Act provide any explicit protections or autonomy for independent regulatory agencies? You did mention the vote at the end that could overturn it, or are they subject to any same review mechanisms as executive branch agencies? So, Susan, do you want to take those, and we'll then ask others?
Quickly, the argument for the Paperwork Reduction Act was to try to minimize the burdens that the public faced, and to make sure that minimize burdens, duplication, and overlap, and to make sure that any collections of information demanded of the public was necessary. The question about whether benefit cost analysis is everything is required, it really is a function of how the significance of the regulation, how big an impact. So the bigger the impact, the larger the requirement. And that comes from executive order, from that Clinton executive order. Some statutes require some of that analysis, but the executive order is the one that applies it across agencies, unless a statute requires something else. And the override, as you said, yes, the difference in the Paperwork Reduction Act is that independent agencies can override a disapproval with a majority vote of the commissioners.
Great, thank you. All right, we have two additional questions. I'm gonna put them together just to save time. So the first question is, can the participants discuss how the mere presence of a minority commissioner exercises executive power? That is, would it be constitutional for a president to be guaranteed a majority and thus control the executive power? And then the next question is, what are the implications of due process on internal agency adjudication due to the assertion of an at-will removal, given the executive branch is now judging its own case? Who wants to take that?
Well, I think one interesting question is going to be how strong a unitary executive theory is the Supreme Court going to adopt? I mean, we were all talking about these four cause removal protections, which have really been the focus, particularly with respect to the commissioners that have been fired. But if it's within the president's sort of sole discretion, you know, who he employs within the executive branch, and we're seeing this play out, throughout the federal government, a number of cases that are working their way out through the courts, reductions in force that are happening. I mean, if this is the president's prerogative, why should it be that Congress can place a limitation on partisan balance? And why is even that constitutional? I don't think that's been as front and center yet, but why should it be that the president has to tolerate, two-fifths of every multi-member commission just being at complete odds, with his policies. So, I mean, it may not matter as a functional, so long as there's a quorum, as Howard was saying, so long as you've got a functioning, a workable majority. But there may be cases in which that does matter. I mean, kind of a key, one commission, for example, Federal Election Commission. This is kind of, that actually statute, I believe, mandates partisan balance, sort of equal balance. So it's sort of, it's, you know, that's even kind of a bigger a test case than the ones where there's a partisan majority. But, Svetlana, in your second question concerning, being the judge in your own case, I think those are the due process questions that cases like Jarkissi and some of the non-delegation issues that are working their way up through the courts are grappling with. I mean, can you have the executive branch itself through these administrative tribunals both act as, prosecutor, judge, and jury all in one? And so there are a number of cases working their way through the courts. I mean, for cause removal, how does that apply to administrative law judges? Is that constitutional? Can these administrative bodies impose civil penalties on regulated parties? And then how much judicial review should they get on the back end of that? There are a number of cases currently working their way through the courts, multiple circuits involving the FCC and its enforcement powers. Is it enough that you get kind of a back end de novo look by a district court after you've been run through the ringer at the FCC and have a huge civil penalty imposed against you? So I think all of these due process questions we're going to see work their way up through the courts in the next few years.
Howard, you're on mute.
You're on mute, Howard. Howard,
can you unmute?
I'm sorry. I've always thought the due process questions are there regardless of whether the agency is independent or not. I mean, what always saved it for me at the FTC was it used to be that cases took so long that they were in fact decided by a different set of commissioners than the one who issued the complaint. But that's not true anymore. It's the same people. And they are judging their own complaint that they issued. And that, to me, is the heart of the due process issue.
Well, thank you so much, everyone. Thanks to the audience for the questions. I see that we are over time, so I'd like to thank all the panelists for being here. Really appreciate your thoughts. Please check out the materials on our website that Adam mentioned. They're great resources for more information. With that, I'll turn it over to Edie.
Yeah, on behalf of the Federalist Society, we'd just like to thank everyone so much, Howard, Susan, Thomas, and Adam for speaking with us today. And thank you, Svetlana, for moderating. We really appreciate your time and expertise. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and other upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.